Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. You know, before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the rise of outlaw country music and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision in her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. Hey, it's Bobby Bones. Hey, I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the St. Jude kids. St. Jude's doing incredible work fighting childhood cancer. And because of donations like the ones that you give, families never receive a bill ever from St. Jude for treatment, travel, housing, food, none of that. Help St. Jude stop childhood cancer. Become a partner in hope. Get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. It's going to look great on you. So join all the doctors, researchers, and me in this fight. All right, text the word Bobby. It's only six numbers to 785-833. Again, text the word Bobby to just these six numbers, 785-833. This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for four lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with four lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p.
I think it was probably a trying time for Andy sitting across from me, but he set up a little black and white TV in the kitchen for me, and the Yankees were on, and I was a Yankees guy, and he put it on, and he kept just, he'd walk over a couple hours and just walk up and just say, do you like Famous Amos cookies? And I go, yeah. And drop off a cookie and walk away.
Welcome to episode 391, Sam Hollander. That was it. There's a little driving range near my house. I went to it for like 30 minutes yesterday. Had my golf clubs in the back of the car. Had a little time to kill. And so I stopped and hit some balls. And I was listening to the Weezer song, Records, the new song. I got records in my head. And
here you go. In my head everywhere that I go.
And so Sam Hollander wrote that song. And we talk about it coming up in a minute. But that's new Weezer. But I could list you, and I think I probably will, but I'm going to say he's got a book called 21 Hit Wonder. And you can get it at samhollandersongs.com, or you can search 21 Hit Wonder on Amazon. That being said, I felt like I could have done 2 to 3 hours with Sam. He just had a story about everything from who his babysitter was, his parents, all the songs that he wrote. And I can list some of them here. Panic at the Disco, High Hopes. Fits in the Tantrums, Hand Clap.
I can make your hands clap.
Boys Like Girls, The Great Escape. Gym Class Heroes, he produces when a Cupid Chokehold. Metro Station, Shake It. He's just got so much. He's got over 22 U.S. top 40 hits, 10 number ones, 10 top fives, 87 top tens globally. His songs have streamed over 5 billion times. In 2019, he held the number one position on the Billboard Rock Songwriters chart for 9 weeks, which was a year-end record. I don't know, I like the guy. You know, I always will kind of feel their energy and hopefully give that back to them so they feel comfortable. And what I liked about Sam was he's like, hey, man, what's up? Sam, we're hanging out. We're chilling. He's so dry.
Laid back.
Sometimes I didn't know if he was joking or not. And then I just sit there and be like, I'm going to let you say the next thing because I don't know if you're kidding or not. Like talking about the Baja Men when he worked with them. There was just a lot where I was like, I don't know if he's kidding. And then sometimes he wasn't kidding.
Especially the Kidz Bop stuff.
Yeah, Kidz Bop. I was like, is this a joke? Turns out it wasn't a joke. So just a really cool story. I mean, Sam spent 30 years just kind of fighting through the songwriting and the rapping and the producing. And he put all this in a book and he's speaking at a lot of places and he's donating all the money to musicians on call. It's a very inspiring story. It's a very entertaining story. And again, samhollandersongs.com or 21 Hit Wonder. That's the name of the book. You can buy it on Amazon. What was your main takeaway here, Mike, with Sam?
That you can get it start later in life.
Yeah, he didn't write his first number one till
35. That's crazy.
After he had failed doing other things hard. Then, you know, there's a story. I never want to say too much in this part of it because it's so good. But there's one story about a tragedy happening, like right when he's about to launch something. So if it wasn't him failing, it was like things happening around it that caused things not to go right. But then he hit it. and I hope you like it. I enjoyed it a whole bunch. Here he is. And follow him on Instagram. If you even want to see what his face looks like, I like to do that. At Sam Hollander. And here he is. Sam, how is your day today?
Hey, what's up, Bobby?
Pretty good?
Pretty glorious, man.
You know, here's my problem. The shirt I'm wearing, the t-shirt, I think it's a woman's shirt. This one. I didn't realize it. And then I was looking in the mirror and I was like, that's a woman's shirt. So I put this on over the top. So you think that's at least kind of cool.
Was that from your Zumba class?
You know, that's the one class I haven't done. Okay. Zumba. Have you ever been to Zumba?
You know, honestly, I don't want to make this awkward for you, but I actually trademarked the name Zumba. I actually created Zumba.
You did not.
I am the forbidden dance.
You did not trademark Zumba. I mean, you've done everything else.
All right, man.
Have you ever been to a Zumba class, though?
I've actually witnessed a Zumba class.
But you haven't done it?
No, look at me.
Have you done Tai Bo back in the day? I used to do Tai Bo.
Can I say something true?
Yeah.
I actually had a song on a Tai Bo VHS.
Really?
100%
with
true.
Billy Blanks, baby.
Billy Blanks.
So what song was that, though?
It was called Supersonic Love, and the royalties from that would definitely paid for the bottle of water you guys were nice enough to... push in my direction.
So it wasn't like a massive song they wanted to put in it.
No. It was a filler song. It was a song that of like many of my other early releases that was dropped by a record label, and I found a way to make $5 off of it. So,
you know, when I was going through your entire catalog of songs you wrote and produced, and it's so many massive hits, and you know, the song that I really liked of yours that I felt like it was going to and it still is sometimes because they play a clip of it in stadiums all the time, is Hand Clap.
That's a fun little ditty.
Yeah, because they do a lot of that in the stadiums.
I was a pioneer in jock jams. You know what I mean? That's a jock jam. It's like, remember the Tommy Boy jock jams compilations?
Absolutely. Right. I had Jock Jam 1 in Fuego.
Yes.
I had Jock Jam 2. Are you ready for this? Dun, 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 dun. And then it was just one to the other.
I actually sat in on the commercial for Jock Jams 2. My friend Kennedy directed it, and I got to watch Michael Buffer do his thing in real time on a commercial, which was pretty cool.
Because he does in the middle of the Jock Jam.
Yes.
Even the single version, when I was on, because I did pop radio for a long time, he would do the, let's get ready to rumble.
That's right.
Bam, 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 bam. Oh, man. That's like...
So Hand Clap was my version of a jock jam, I guess. I don't think it was necessarily constructed that way, but it's funny. I mean, it's still played at every sporting thing around the world, and it's neat, especially in New York, because I hear it, you know, at the Yankee games, at the Knick games, at the Neck games. It's kind of fun.
Do you ever stand up and wave? That's what I would do when that's played, just stand up and be like, that's me.
If I do that, then that's the moment they stop playing it. When they realize what I look like, that'll be the end of it.
When I look at, again, your massive body of work, there are so many even micro hooks or catchy things that I think, na 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 na.
That was a fun
na 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 na.
Yeah, that I'm not responsible for that. I just took a free ride on it.
Na na na.
But it's a nice little ditty. No,
man.
Here's the thing. One thing I would say is I love immediacy in music. You know what I mean? And I think it's born out of the fact that I think most kids today have, you know, severely warped attention spans. So when I'm digging in, I'm really just trying to get it in the intro immediately. And, you know,
TikTok before it was TikTok? That's what it sounds like.
I mean, I got to
tell
you
something. You got a few seconds.
I'll put it like this. If I had been born in a previous decade, I would not have been able to make Emerson, Lake and Palmer records. You know what I mean? It would have been a very different wiring. So there's no 12-minute intro in my vocab. So
I was listening yesterday to Derek and the Dominoes, Layla, and, you know, the song plays, and Layla, and it's not the Clapton Unplugged. It's the, you know, the original, you know. And at the end, it's a 5-minute
piano sojourn. Yeah, it's the greatest
departure ever. That's a whole different time.
Look, man, I wish I could have been that guy, but truthfully, I would have been the guy who would have said to them, "Hey, man, let's edit this thing down. Let's make it to like 2 minutes and 40 seconds of joy."
Yeah, I can enjoy older songs from before even, you know, we were making anything creatively. Yeah. If it's jokes or music, I can enjoy the process and how culture was different then. But even that outro and that song, I was like, were they high?
Drugs.
Yeah, it was just, it just continued on and on. And I've heard it 100 times. But as I'm in my car, and we have an old Bronco that just has terrestrial radio only.
Awesome.
And I was like, I don't know what the channels are, so I'm not going to change it. So I'm going to listen to this 4-minute outro of the entire Layla.
You got to stick it out.
Which is the exact opposite of na-na-na-na, because immediately you got us with Cupid's Chokehold.
You know what? That was the genius of Travis McCoy. And he was driving it, and he, once again, he let me hitch onto his wagon on that one. But no, it's just, I really, really, I do like going for the jugular early on, you know, and maybe it's, I have no sense of dynamic anymore, and I'm just warped, but I really just like things just sort of from initial onset. I just wanted to hit.
Where did that come from? Or what music did you like? Or what was it that you didn't like so much that made you go, we got to grab them quick?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I grew up, I was the definitive K-Tel kid. You know what I mean? I was like this, you know, late 70s, early 80s. I had all those K-Tel collections. And that's what I loved because it wasn't genre specific for the most part, you know? So you could have Seals and Crofts next to David Gates, next to, you know, next to the Bellamy Brothers, next to the Bee Gees or some disco stuff or Kiss. So that was my introduction to music. And the one thing I would say is, you know, it was usually the 3-minute edit on all those songs. They weren't going to let anything go extended. So I began to hear songs truly as like a 3-minute single. And I remember when I was 20 or so and Dramarama hit. And I remember hearing, not Dramarama. What's the Delamitri with Roll to Me,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
When Roll to Me hit. Yeah. But that thing's like 2 minutes and 2 seconds.
Roll to Me.
It's the fastest song in history. And what I realized about that song was one reason why I crushed it radio is because you could fit it into any slot going to a commercial. You know, it was so short that it could work as a bumper to things. So then I just sort of got into that notion. So I guess I am a TikTok pioneer, Bobby.
That's what I thought, because everything goes quick. Short attention span. You hit us quick. You give us what we're going to need to know when that song's over. And if we don't listen to all of it, that's fine. But if we do, we got it. I could do that with many of your songs. Shake It, Metro Station.
Shake It's a Zumba classic.
Now, see, when you talk about Zumba, you lose me a little bit, and I think you're kidding because you only witnessed one. If you said Taibo, I'd believe you because you probably saw a few more of those since you made $5 off of it.
I wouldn't say a few more, Bobby.
growing up in New York, how much of your childhood to early adulthood were you there mostly?
I was there every day. I mean, the city was like this.
Until what age?
I was in New York till I was the age of 40.
Okay.
So I never left.
So does that mean you're a Billy Joel guy?
I'm a Springsteen and Billy Joel guy, which is kind of a rarity. You know what I mean? They're in the tri-state area, I do sometimes feel there's like a defined Mason-Dixon between the two.
It's almost Mets-Yankees.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
I'm definitely Yankees. But for Billy, you know, it's funny because Billy's thing I love on the theatricality, and I love the nods to, you know, Sinatra and all the, you know, sort of Rat Pack kind of crooners, some of the way he fused like theatrical croonerdom, you know? And then Springsteen, I love the wordplay. So Springsteen was a huge influence for me because I really, really dug, especially on Greetings from Asbury Park, that first record. He's pulling all this Dylan stuff, but there's just something about what he was doing melodically on that first record that blew my head. That was one of my first favorite records. So
there had to be so much music around you, even if you didn't get to go to it, just be living in New York City. I mean, I grew up in Mountain Pine, Arkansas. There was no music around me.
Right.
So anything I got had to be only from the radio or driving to get a tape, which later turned into a CD.
So it was like the nearest big venue.
Hour and a half. And
wow.
And it was Little Rock.
Wow.
And
it's another animal.
Every 3 months.
Right.
You know,
right.
So was it important to whomever was raising you to make sure that you were cultured at all while living in New York?
1,000%. Like, you know, I was exposed to the arts early on. My I know this will appeal to you, but my dad was a modern dancer. And I know you're very well versed in the
very
dance.
Very modern and dancing.
Yeah. Well, you're a champion,
yeah,
dance
absolutely
champion.
Absolutely, world champion.
It's very, very important to, my dad was a dancer, and then he became an architect, but he was a professional dancer at 18.
What kind of dancer? What did he specialize in?
He was with the Jose Limon group doing modern dance in the 1950s.
And how did he get started in that?
He started dancing at like 11, was professional at 17, toured the entire world, broke every toe on both feet by the time he was 23, went back to Yale and became an architect.
Do you remember him dancing at all?
No, I wasn't.
Okay, so you were...
I'm not 200. Yeah. Jeez, man.
But I didn't know if he still like danced recreationally.
He didn't dance recreationally, but you know what's funny? He would sway around the ring. He was an incredible guy, man. He was just so rhythmic and cool. So when I'd listen to music and I sort of was less versed in my steps, I would watch him in the background listen to music, and the way he flowed was magical. It was beautiful. And my mom was an artist too, so...
Your mom was what kind of artist?
My mom was a heavy cat, man. My mom was she was an interior designer, but she came from the bottom of this thing. She just started at the very pit of this thing, and she became an expert on Victorian era furniture, and which was a very strange sort of lane. And she really became like one of the foremost experts on it overnight, and started doing apartments. But when I was a little kid, she was sort of carrying our thing, and she did Mick Jagger's apartment, Yves Saint Laurent's apartment, all these sort of Studio 54 era things. And, you know, when I was a little guy, this is probably how I got a book deal, but when I was a little guy, you know, and I was always pleading for her to take me to record shops, one day she said, "I'm going to drop you off at a babysitter's house. I got to get rid of you." And she dropped me off at Andy Warhol's, and Andy Warhol used to babysit me as a little kid.
Which is wild. I know that you wrote about that in your book.
It's true.
And my next question was, is your book true or lies? And so you answered that. It's true, too. Yeah. That's good. I like that, because I mean, we can keep going here.
Thanks. Yeah, that's good.
Andy Warhol as a babysitter. Do you have memories of that, or was it before you were...
No, I do. I do. It happened, I want to say three, maybe a fourth time, and then he used to come to our house, too. I have very distinct memories, because this was somebody who probably wasn't that stoked to hang out with, like, a greasy little kid with nose boogers running down his face, you know? So... It was, I think it was probably a trying time for Andy sitting across from me, but you know, he set up a little black and white TV in the kitchen for me, and it was a little black and white TV, and the Yankees were on, and I was a Yankees guy, and he put it on, and he'd walk over a couple hours and just walk up and just say, "Do you like Famous Amos cookies?" And I go, yeah. And drop off a cookie and walk away. That was about the extent of our fraternization, but he was pretty cool. Like, you know.
Your mom and dad are very interesting to me.
They pushed the arts. So
yeah, childhood.
Yeah, when I played high school football, they thought literally like I had failed.
How did they meet? Do you know?
I do know. My mom was widowed at 23, and she was widowed, and she was a single mom. And she met my dad through a friend in the city, just like casually.
And so I assume their bond was something artistic, creative. It sounds like they both have that spirit inside of them.
They were incredible, man. They were like both, like both of their aesthetics were at like a level I've never seen. They were both, everything about them, you know, they lived in this little studio apartment in the city, and they tricked this thing out to such an extent in like 1969 or before I was born, but it was in magazines. It was featured because the level of design was so sophisticated and cool. Like they were just like, they were brilliant minds.
What do you remember as far as their parenting? What was the priority from them to you as for just being a good human? Like, what were they trying to teach you?
Well, I gotta be honest with you. They were very decent people. And, you know, I think the number one thing they wanted to teach me, one was aspirational things, that everything was obtainable. You know, I was blessed to have, like a support network that other kids didn't have, you know what I mean? Like, and that's never been lost on me. Like when you're entering this business and you have two parents who are cheering for you, hoping that you enter something or do something different or color outside the lines, that's pretty cool, you know? So I would say I was blessed with that. And then, you know, they were so kind, and they're so gracious. And in our town specifically, we lived an hour north in northern Westchester, and the way they approached everybody, they were known. They'd just be like very generous, decent people. Like they would talk to everybody. That was one thing that was pushed on me early on. It's just, you know, have no fear of talking to people, look people in the eye, and like honestly, just like be a human, you know?
I ask all the childhood stuff because
I grew into a sociopath.
I was going to get there later about that specifically. Cool. But it's, you know, when I'm reading about you and reading different parts of the book, the mic was like, yeah, you got to read this, you got to read this. That you didn't have a hit until you were 35. Is that accurate?
That's completely true.
Going from memory.
Completely
now,
true.
You had these parents that said you can do anything. They didn't really set boundaries for you except the boundary of you can push the boundary as much as you'd like.
Hustle.
Yeah.
Just hustle.
Just go.
Just hustle.
And so you're 18, 19, even up to 24, 25. Like, where did you see your life going? What was the goal? What was the plan then?
Well, the plan from day one was I really... you know, I was a student of records, right? I mean, you know, I collected records the way other kids collected baseball cards. Probably had a couple thousand records by the time I was about 23, 24, because there were flea markets in the city in the mid-20s, the 23rd, 24th, 25th, where you could buy nickel records. So I used to stockpile nickel records. And I was a voracious collector. I was looking at the back and just trying to figure out who the songwriters were, who the producers were. I grew up watching a lot of films, so I got really into screenwriting, right? So I nerded out over screenwriters. Like, I wanted to be Albert Brooks or John Hughes or one of these cats, you know? And so with the songwriting, it was the same thing. And as far as my parents went, you know, they unleashed me into the city. You know, I went to school, I dropped out. I went to 3 colleges in 2 semesters, which I think is pretty unheard of. And I ended up clawing the city, but I really did have one singular goal. And that was, I wanted to write with artists and really just be that voice in the room who sort of directed the movie a little bit. You know what I mean? Who wrote the script and sort of, it was a trick I learned from Nile Rodgers down the road, but I was early in my head, that was in my wiring, which was to constantly try to write the sequel to whatever any artist, doesn't matter if they're unknown or they've just put up their first song or whatever, I'm creating the next movie. Like, where would it go? What's the pivot? What's Weekend in Bernie's 2, you know? And, that's what I started doing. And the problem was, this guy named Kurt Cobain came along, this jerk, and he wrote his own songs. And so it became super, I was 20, and suddenly it was super inherently uncool to collaborate with an outside guy outside the room. You know, previously, you go back to Appetite for Destruction for GNR or any of those Eagles records, you know, and there's co-writers all over these things. Carole King wrote It's Too Late with Tony Stern, you know? So there was a place for that person to be in the room who sort of is that other sort of a appendage creatively, but isn't part of the group. And suddenly it wasn't in vogue anymore. It wasn't cool. And so I had to claw my way through the city at that time, and I had to eat. So I, Bobby, I was a rapper, and I got a record deal as a rapper.
Okay, I don't know if you're kidding, because I also had a record deal as a rapper.
I did.
My name is Captain Caucasian. What was your name?
We're going to find out. This is this could be a Bobby Cass trivia question for anyone who writes in. But
Nobody writes in.
Okay, yeah. That's a problem. But I did get a record deal with Select Records, which is Atlantic's hip hop record. So they had, at the time, they had Kid and Play, Chubb Rock, UTFO. Kid and Play were on top of the world.
What year was this, by the way?
This is 1991.
Okay, so Beastie Boys have been around for a little bit.
Beastie's been around. Right. Third Bass had come out, and they were big
in
the city.
Like Third Bass, Pop Goes the Weasel, right?
Yeah, that was big in the city. And then I was shopping when Vanilla Ice came out. And it was funny because Vanilla Ice's label tried to sign me. They flew me down to Plano, Texas, Ultrax Records. And I remember... pivotal moment in my youth. I'm probably 20 years old, maybe. Yeah, I just probably turned 20. And they took me into a closet, and it was all the Vanilla Ice merch. You know what I mean? Vanilla Ice toothbrushes, lunch boxes, you know, whatever. It was like, it was so dystopian. And I remember thinking, I've entered into like a universe I could never understand. But I made this record. I got signed. I had a video out, and then I got dropped within 2 weeks. You know what I mean?
What's the record?
It's called... Notorious B.I.G.
Yeah, I've heard of it. And I have heard of it. Yeah, that's good. You know, good for you.
But after my failed hip hop.
What was wrong with the record?
I made it myself. So the biggest mistake was, I got a record deal, and immediately Select tried to hook me up with producers. So Bob Power wanted to work with me, and he had engineered and mixed all those Tribe Called Quest records. And then they hooked me with these guys, Trackmasters, who would go on to do all of the Diddy and Mace stuff and getting jiggy with it and all that 90s big sample heavy hip hop. These guys all wanted to work with me. And I, of course, turned it all down to make my own record because I was very headstrong. I didn't want to collaborate with anybody. And I made the worst album ever recorded. So I made this terrible recording, and I lost my record deal by the time it came out. It was shelved for a year. They finally like threw it against the wall. And then Bobby, I decided to start rapping with a German accent because I think that was my next pivot. So I felt like I was doing cultural appropriation I was an early cultural appropriator. So I started,
TikTok and cultural appropriation.
Yeah, I did. So I started rapping with a German accent, and I did that.
But why? Like, because why was that a good idea?
Eurodance was beginning to explode. Remember the Berman Brothers and all that stuff?
Were you a different person? Did you change your name? So you were then the German person, that's a terrible German accent, but you'd be like, I am German.
Yes. So if you ever watch Whoopi Goldberg and Eddie, she's coaching the Knicks.
She's angry Whoopi yelling at the Knicks. My song plays. She's like yelling at a Knick, and it's in the background. You can hear my weird German flow in the background. A little pronounced, but that didn't work.
Hang tight. The Bobbycast will be right back.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com.
Tecovas.com.
Tecovas. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How do the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer shaped the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed as the Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts. That's where they would spur each other and tap into something bigger and something realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Backrack as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer, and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
Hey, it's Amy Brown here to talk about the incredible work that's being done by St. Jude Children's Research Hospital and to ask you today to join me in becoming a partner in hope. When you make a donation to St. Jude, you're helping an organization that has helped push the overall childhood cancer survivor rate from 20% to more than 80%. And I can tell you from personal experience, that number and the hope that it brings is invaluable. Families do not have to worry about a thing. Treatment is covered, travel, housing, food. And when you're a family that's going through this, like imagine you're a parent, your kid gets cancer. You need to focus on that child. You don't need to be worrying about other things. And financial stuff can get really stressful. St. Jude covers it. Your support means families never receive a bill from St. Jude for treatment. And when you sign up for just $19 a month, you're going to get the new This Shirt Saves Lives tee. So join me in helping St. Jude in the fight against childhood cancer. Become a partner in hope and text Bobby to 785-833. That's B-O-B-B-Y to 785-833.
Welcome back to the Bobbycast.
Then I started making beats, and so that's when I started doing lots of programming and making beats. And
were your beats good on your record, though? You talk about you made your own records.
I did. My beats were terrible on my record. So then, back then, I actually worked with a programmer on it. But then when I started making beats, I actually got an SP-12, and my beats were all right. I could do it, and I sort of had the tricks of the era of all that sort of detuned hip-hop stuff. But
do you think, though, that bad record, bad, you said it, not me, yeah, though, the failure there, and I guess the point that I'm hoping that I'm leading us to, is that there was a lot of learning that happened from that failure.
It's the best thing that ever happened to me.
Right.
Failure. See, the reason I wrote this book is because the failure defined me, you know? I read every entertainment bio for the most part, you know, of my peers, certainly songwriter books, et cetera. And a lot of them are humble brags, you know, and I understand it's part of the game. But for me, what was interesting about my story was the first 15 years of the career, not the second half. The second half's been magical, but it's not why I wrote a book. I wrote a book because the stuff at the front end was so fascinating, because I made every possible tactical and creative error you could ever make. And I always learn from the lessons. So I make my first record and it's a colossal miss. And you know what I learned? I need to be a collaborator.
I might not be good enough on my own to pull off what I think, what I'm hearing in my head, I'm not able to execute. So then it was like speed dating, years of speed dating collaborators to try to find like the magic fit. And so everything was just like this weird learning curve. I started doing music for commercials, doing music for industrials, Garnier, Maybelline, all this stuff. And basically, then I started creating my own groups because I figured if they, if I created the group, they'd have no choice but to sing my songs.
Quality theory.
I mean, it felt good on paper.
Yeah.
So the first five albums I made were major. I got, you know, my manager, Brett, was at the time, was able to get five major label deals for artists over a two-year period, which was unheard of. We had nothing. We had never done anything. I'd never done anything. And I had the distinction of the first five albums I ever made weren't released. And you go, well, how does that work? Well, because there's no internet, no Spotify, nothing. This is not, you know, whatever, 98, 99, 2000. So no iTunes. So back then it's still physical CDs. And as you know, like a bunch of records, they'd sign 30X a year or whatever, but a couple were tax write-offs. Mine were always the write-off. So the first five albums didn't come out. The sixth finally is the one that breaks through. It was a group called Bad Ronald that took out an ad in the Village Voice in New York, cast this thing. We went to, we recorded at Henson in LA. And I had a panic attack in the middle of it because I knew this was my last shot in this business. And
why did you think that was your last shot, though?
Well, because when you have five albums on major labels.
But you had five. It's such a weird number to go, well, my sixth certainly isn't going to work.
Well, because you know what? The phone just wasn't ringing.
Got it.
You know what I mean? Like, no one's taking my calls. And I think I was somebody who generally people rooted for. But, you know, man, it's like at some point you're like, you're a draft pick. And at some point, you know, you're going to get cut. Your stock isn't there. And that's where I was at. And so I was just at the very bottom of this thing. And we make this album and the floodgates open and I have a song on MTV, right? And it's the first song ever. Bad Ronald, Let's Begin. Song on MTV, most magical feeling in the world. Crying, first song ever, literally in a video, because up to that, the only TV usage I had was background music in Real World Seattle. Yeah, it's true. And so we have this thing, and on the night of the record release, as you remember, you know, record store releases were Tuesdays. So the Monday night before it, most record stores stay open to midnight and you'd have record release Monday nights. You know what I mean? And so all throughout the city, like whatever you were a fan of in New York City, those people would congregate for the record release of that record and you'd go to the record stores. So our record was this, it was the Easy Rider helmet from the movie, American Flag. And it was displayed at 14th and Broadway in the Virgin Megastore. And we had the flat on the corner of Broadway. Sky high. It was the coolest thing I'd ever seen, right? So we went to take pictures there directly before it. It was the most magical feeling. I was so excited. And we were there at midnight and went to bed. Next morning, woke up, it was September 11th, 2001. Mm-hmm. And as I ran down the street, I watched the towers fall from Washington Square Park around the corner. And then when I ran uptown and all these people are running towards me covered in soot and all these people are screaming, looking for family members, they're all congregating in Union Square. So the press trucks are there and the press start photographing and the city, you know, all the news trucks are photographing our album cover with people covered in white dust past the American flag. So it was the most harrowing, just awful day, obviously, in my life. And, you know, I never went back to that store for 2.5 years and I didn't fly for 2 years. And Bad Ronald were dropped within 3 weeks because their record was just like loud, abrasive, sort of raunchy hip hop and rock hip hop, you know. And that wasn't what people wanted on September 12th. They wanted Norah Jones, you know. So that was the end for me. So I the phone stopped ringing and I had to take a side hustle, so I started making beats on Kidz Bop Records. That's not, I'm serious.
And that's why I'm pausing here.
I'm serious.
So when you say making beats, so you're...
How about this? I wasn't even producing. I was the drum programmer.
So you're making as close to as possible, like the real version, but a little softer version of the songs now.
Family friendly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you get that job?
Gary Phillips was a guitar player I'd used. He had done session work. He actually did the entire Bad Ronald record. He was amazing. He had produced a singer-songwriter named Michael Tolcher, a record that I'd done that didn't really happen. And he'd become my session guy. And he got the gig as the main producer for Kidz Bop. He still is.
And he knew that I was having a hard time, and he knew that my phone had stopped ringing and I wasn't going to quit. So he gave me, like, he started throwing me little vigs, like, hey, do the Beyonce Crazy in Love Kids Bop. And as I always say, that's my hot beat on that, man. So in case you tonight want to do the Forbidden Mambo to that thing, I got you. It's my beat. So
when did you start to reestablish, even within yourself, who you were?
Well, I met a guy who changed my life. I met a guy named Jonathan Daniel. You know, a couple pivotal things. One thing I need to say is, even in the midst of all the failure and futility, I had the first thing that really changed my life was I met Carole King. And Carole King took an interest in me. And Carole,
how did you just meet Carole King?
I brought her in on one of these records to sing, a record that was never released, a female artist named Tarsha Vega on RCA. And she was like an MC, and it was, once again, acoustics, like sort of like a vibey acoustic hip-hop record. And I brought her in, and I, you know, RCA wanted a feature on the record, and they were suggesting Indiari and people of that era, you know, sort of neo-soul. And I suggested Carole King. And Brian Maloof was the A&R, and he had a relationship with her camp. And 2 days later, she came down to the studio to hang out with us, and she sat across from us, and she's looking at Tarsha, and she said, Tarsha, I love what you do lyrically. I think it's great. I love the nuances, blah, blah, blah. And Tarsha, God bless her, looked at me and said, well, he writes it. I don't write the stuff. He writes it. So next thing you know, me and Carol and my boy Duke, we locked the door for, like, you know, over a year. We probably wrote 10 or 12 songs, I wanted to say. And we just kept, it was a masterclass. It was like the first person, and specifically for me, it was the first person who really identified something in me beyond the fact that I was mildly amusing, you know? And she, we did this thing, and we ended up writing and producing the title track of the last album she ever made. It was the single, the title track. It was like a big Gap commercial with her and her daughter. It was a song called Love Makes the World. And I had a Carole King song. So it was weird, as I had 5 unreleased albums, I had a Carole King song. And then, you know, obviously, you know, my Baha Men work, right?
So I do, and I'm going to get to that too.
Yeah, that was big.
So. Yeah, we got Baha Men to come in a minute. But the Carole King, and, you know, when that's one of the big headlines that you read about you.
Yeah.
First, you know, Carole King, first big breakthrough. Yeah. But I wonder if the breakthrough was that as you're writing these songs, did she, and maybe you didn't need it, but did she give you a kind of a reintroduction to your confidence?
Yeah, it's just, you know what, because I entered the building as the fan first, I always wanted to work with all the real building cats. You know what I mean? So the notion that somebody so esteemed could find something in my writing, that offset all the failure to me, because at least I felt like I was getting grandmothered into something. So then she told Paul Williams about me, and Paul Williams was one of my favorite writers ever. I was a massive Paul Williams fan because he was like me. He was a lyricist and he was sort of kooky. And so suddenly me and Paul and Carol and Duke are writing songs together, right? And she was an advocate for me, and I desperately needed it. And so that gave me some currency in my head. And then, but this, you know, a guy named Jonathan Daniel is the guy who really changed my career. He was his manager, and, you know, he was about, you know, 8 years older than me, something like that. And he'd been in hair bands in the 80s, at the same kind of trajectory, though, like just dancing around all these scenes in the, you know, like in the way I was dancing around scenes in New York City, but never really having his own moment, that breakout moment. He was, you know, his band was called Candy. It was Jonathan and Gilby Clark, and then Gilby Clark joins GNR. Then, you know, and he then became a publisher. He was running the Cure's publishing company in the U.S. That sort of ran its course, and he starts a management company called Crush Management. And he started reaching out to me, and he would get advanced copies of all these albums that I was making that weren't getting released. And he would take me out to lunch and give me these pep talks, and he understood what I was pulling from, right? So he'd sit across from me and say, oh, that's really cool. You're going for like a Bones How Turtles thing on this, or you're going for a Love and Spoonful thing on this, or you're going for a Dennis Lambert thing, or, you know, these idols, all these songwriters that I idolized like a nerd, you know? And he was the only person who understood my references. And he said to me, look, he said, you know, I'm on the precipice of something, but I have a whole wave of bands. They're pop punk. And this is growing into a scene. And we're going to need somebody who, you know, maybe an adult in the room who understands song a step more with a few of the acts. And they were these little indie records, no budget, fueled by Ramen Records, run out of Jacksonville, you know, a dorm at Gainesville originally with John Janik. And I signed up. And the first record ever made, you know, so understand, now I'm coming out of it. It ended up being seven albums. I made major label albums, real budgets, right? Real budgets. And first five aren't released. The sixth comes out on September 11th. And the seventh was a group called the Cooler Kids that DreamWorks folded in the, as the record came out. So they were folded in Interscope and they were dropped. So I've made all these major label records for budgets. And then suddenly here I am. And I'm pitched these records for, you know, $25,000 all in for everything. Mixing, mastering, production, you know, sample clearances if they used them, you know. So I'm losing money on these things. The first record was called The Gym Class Heroes. And I make this record, like you said, you know, and I have my first number one hit. So I went from having absolutely nothing in that 35, I have a number one hit.
Does it happen like... the movie show where you get no calls and then you have a number one hit, then all of a sudden the phone's like bang, 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 bring in, and everybody wants to work with you?
1,000%. But what's interesting about it was one thing, Jonathan Daniels is basically my guru. He's one of my best friends, but he's also been my guru, and I'm with Crush Management now too. But one thing he told me early on is he said, you don't necessarily need to take all the calls. You need an infrastructure, about three or four people in this business who believe in you, who've always been very loyal to you. And as long as they're in the position to make some sort of moves, that you can just work with those people. And that's what I chose to do. So there was Steve Greenberg at S-Curve. There was James Diener when he was at Octone, you know, Interscope. There was, the Crush guys and Pete Gambarg and people like, there were people who just like constantly gave me work. So I didn't have to take all that incoming. And it was great for my psyche, because I think it's a massive mistake that writers or producers make when they finally enter the zeitgeist, you know, because you just get so seduced by it. You're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm getting all these calls, blah, blah, blah. But you don't realize that you're fly by night to these other people. You know, that's a transient sort of relationship, but the people who sort of rode with you from the beginning will stick with you through the lows. Because truthfully, for every sort of solid couple of, you know, pockets of where I'm really killing it, then of course there's going to be a fall. It happens. We all just roller coaster up and down.
We were talking about before you got here doing the intro for this, which, by the way, the book 21 Hit Wonder, which we've been talking about, and you write it, and you're donating the proceeds to Musicians on Call, right?
Yeah, so every penny from my end from this book, from inception, goes to Musicians on Call, and all my speaking gigs too. So I've been touring around the country on my own dime. I went to, been to 30 universities so far, 5 high schools. I'm gonna get up to 50. And I've done, you know, everything from a General Motors convention last Tuesday to, you know, music business colleges convention, the MIA convention in Las Vegas on Friday. Every penny that I raise goes to Musicians on Call. And
why? And I say that as someone who was on the board for a while. And someone,
I know,
who was very...
Yeah, you've been involved in it.
Right.
Well, the long and short of it is... I knew the gentleman who started it when we were all in our 20s. And I didn't really get involved. And then... when my dad was in his last days, he was at Mount Sinai. He was in a cancer ward at Mount Sinai. And I just lost my mom, and now my dad's really sick. And I'm in a pretty dark space. And I walk up there, and I hear a man singing in the hallway. He's kind of warming up. And I walk out. It's like an 80-year-old cat with a big bushy beard and acoustic guitar. And he's walking into a room to play for an elderly woman in the next room. And so I waited till he was completed, and I took him aside. I said, look, who are you? He said, I'm with Musicians on Call. And literally my face froze, because I had, I'd always wanted to get involved, and I felt like this was this weird, divine sort of religious experience. So I immediately signed on, joined the advisory board. And then we have this Christmas group. It's me and Kevin Griffin, Mark McGrath. It's a bunch of us, Lisa Loeb. And we do this thing called Band of Merrymakers. And so we gave proceeds to it. And we started playing in the hospitals and like doing the workshops. And I was doing writing clinics like with kids who were in really tough shape. And it is the most valuable work I've ever done. I figured, you know, there's a lot of charities that get a ton of shine and have more financial resources. And I felt, well, if I could do anything to help, it was worth it.
The Bobby Cast. We'll be right back.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or you like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com.
T-E-C-O-V-A-S.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How do the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer shaped the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed as the Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, that's where they would spur each other and tap into something bigger and something realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Backrack as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer, and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest. Hey, it's Bobby Bones. I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the kids at St. Jude. St. Jude's been leading the way in the world's best survival rates for some of the most aggressive forms of childhood cancer. Your support means that families never get a bill from St. Jude for treatment or travel or housing or food, so the families can focus on helping their child live. And that really hits home for me because I've been to St. Jude many times. I've hung out with the kids, played music for the kids. I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. Now, I didn't have cancer, but if it wasn't for people stepping up, I don't know that I would have been able to go and stay in the hospital and be taken care of. So that's why we do this, to take care of others. You can help St. Jude stop childhood cancer by becoming a partner in hope. When you do this, you'll get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. So join all the doctors and researchers, you know, and me in this fight, and just text the word Bobby to 785-833. It's only six numbers, but text the word Bobby to 785-833.
This is the Bobby Cast.
When you speak at any of the things you said, a college, a convention, a bunch of executives, what's your one story that you know is going to light the room up? People are going to love it. They're going to be entertained. You may twist and turn on them a little bit, but you know that's your money story.
Oh, man. Bobby, the truth is, I'm a walking money story.
I know. That's why I'm asking you, like, what's your antidote that you're like, this is the one I want to be known? Not what song did you write or produce, but what's your one antidote that you want to be known for?
All right. You ready?
Yeah.
All right. So I really think the One Direction one lands a lot because kids like Harry Styles. So very quickly, I'm sitting in a coffee shop in L.A. It's raining. And, you know, everybody in L.A. is scared of rain. So they're all on top of each other. And there's a meeting going on behind me, and it's a publisher pitching a writer. And I recognize that's Becca Tischer, who's a huge manager and publisher. And she's pitching the Swedish guy. And he's got very thick accent, you know. And she's like, you know, so you're not doing your band anymore, blah, blah, blah. Or you're starting to write now. You're writing now, blah, blah. I said, yes, I'm beginning to write and blah, blah, blah. For some reason, I turn around and I look at this sexy fella and I realize that it's Peter Svensson, the guitarist in the Cardigans. And the Cardigans for me were my Nirvana.
You know, really?
Cardigans were my favorite band of the night.
By the way, love me, love me, say that you love
exactly.
me.
Exactly.
Yeah, for those that want to hear it perfectly, sing back.
By the way, it was perfect.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so I'm literally fanboying this guy. I interrupt their conversation because I have no filter. And we kick it. And she's like, oh my God, you guys should write together. It'd be such a great fit. And, you know, I'll add my writer, Kojak, who's a track guy, Cool Kojak, and the three of you guys should write. I said, great. So we show up. And secretly, I'm thinking we're going to write a Cardigans song. And this is like my wish fulfillment, you know? And I show up at the studio, and these guys are real pop guys. I'm not a real pop guy. I'm quirky. I'm more of a rock guy who sort of just has pop leanings, you know? And I show up, and these guys are like, I'm like, yeah, so let's dig in. Let's do something really vibey and Cardigans-y. And Peter's like, no, I'm not doing Cardigans anymore. I said, oh, wow.
wow. So I said, what should we do? He said, let's write a song for One Direction. Let's try that. And I didn't know what that meant. You know what I mean? I knew What Makes You Beautiful. That was the extent of my knowledge. I thought it was an incredible single, but this wasn't my forte. So I went outside and Bobby, I got high like I do in these situations, smoke the reefer. And I went outside and I just started writing these words. I write these words and I write an entire lyric and I bring it inside to these guys. I have no idea if it's going to land, you know? And 15 minutes, I'm quick, you know? And I bring it in and the guy starts singing and he's got this Swedish accent, you know, very thick. He's like, do you remember summer 09? Want to go back there every night? And when he's singing, I'm thinking, man, this is like a Fellini movie, man. This is not going to stick, you know? And we finished this thing, finished the song, and I thought it had 0% chance of landing, but I was high and we, you know, ate Thai food and they were nice guys, had a beer. And then I went home and the next day, we're getting texts from Simon Cowell and getting texts from Max Martin and Dr. Luke, and everyone's like, rock me equals smash. So secretly, I'm like, oh my God, what have I been doing in my life, man? Because I've spent my life now at this point, I've worked with, you know, everyone from, you know, I want to say like Train and Daughtry to, you know, Carol to, you know, Tom Jones to a million fun bands with funny t-shirts and funny haircuts. And I'm thinking to myself, why do I have to work with these like soul sucking artists when I could just literally get high and write like these little gibberish words and it lands, you know? So immediately the three of us become like a writing configuration, right? It's me, Kojak, and Peter. And we're gonna be the next writing team, you know, in LA. And I've just moved to LA, dude. So I'm new to all of this, you know? I'm from a very different thing in New York and suddenly it's like teams and blah, but you know. And I start digging in and we write for 30 days straight. We write the 30 worst songs ever written. And the crazy thing is I'm the problem, not those guys. Those guys are really good, but they're dialed in. They're like, let's do Selena Gomez today. I don't know what that is. You know what I mean? So I'm sitting there going, oh, cool, man. I'm going to write like a Smith song, you know? So I'm writing some Morrissey stuff and they're like, wait, no, this isn't landing. It makes no sense. It's not logical. I'm like, but it is. It's deep. You know, so you can see the novelty's wearing off. I'm flying back to Boston, right? And I'm on a plane to Boston from LA. And, you know, Peter sends me a voice note. And now he's cutting my verbal lungs because it's now he's giving me a lyric. And it says, you must sing, I gotta go. I gotta. And he's like, all these gottas, right? And I'm on the plane and I'm literally sitting in this seat and I'm beginning to sweat. I'm so angry. I'm like, why is he making me sing gottas? I don't want to sing gattas. I want my own words on this melody. And so I text him in the plane. He's like, no, it has to be gatta. You gatta. He kept saying that back and forth. The weirdest exchange. Like one of those things where you're like, how are we adults? And this is what we get paid for, you know? And I finally, at the last text back and forth, I was like, yeah, I just don't feel this, man. Those guys never work with me ever again. Okay. Now here's the only problem. I'm driving my kid to school a year later. And I'm listening to Kiss in LA and Ariana Grande's Love Me Harder comes on. Mm. You gotta love me harder. And I heard the gattas and I hadn't heard gatta in a chorus like this repeated. And I just turned to my daughter. She's like six or seven. She's probably seven or eight. And I was like, can you just type something into my phone? Just type writer Ariana Grande, love me harder, Peter Svensson. So, you know, I've played that one wrong, but that was my only foray into One Direction and straight ahead pop stuff. And obviously it's probably not what I do best.
You know a song I love? I was playing it on my radio show just a couple weeks ago. It's a new Weezer song, Records.
That's a fun duty.
And again, it's so... Now that I've spoken with you and kind of hear the macro version of what you're about, even that song starts with what that song is.
Yes.
And when you talk about how you perceive music and you want to get to what to get to fast... I think of old songs like Sweet Emotion. It starts, right? Mm-hmm. Aerosmith, Sweet Emotion. Mm-hmm. Starts with a chorus. Mm-hmm. That's it. It comes back to that. But that's the heat of the song. Mm-hmm. When Records starts, it's the hook.
You go for the jugular.
Right at it.
You know, the thing about Records is I started writing that with Rivers during the pandemic, the front end, in like late 20 or something like that. I was in Cape Cod, and I pulled out an acoustic, and I was singing this idea. And I kept singing, I got records in my head. And I felt like it could land, you know? And I got on Zoom with them, and we kept kicking it back and forth. We kicked it back and forth about a year, year and a half. And it was amazing because we kept debating. There was like an internal debate, I think, about front-loading the hook to that extent. But that's why it works to me. Like it just
and the second hook, just sonically is a little different. It's a little harder, you know. Yeah. I got work, and then the second one comes around
because he pops the octave. Yeah, which, that's my you know, look, man. In my writing, it doesn't matter if it was, you know, when we were doing The Boys Like Girls or We the Kings or Metro, any of those things. Like, the one thing I love is when a chorus just explodes. I like melodies that are kind of static down, sitting in a little box, because that comes from the hip hop stuff, right? So I love melodies that are somewhat linear, and then that gives you room to just have like this big kabow sort of octave jump, and Records does it, right? Like that first chorus, you know, you feel like, oh, it's sort of restrained rivers. And then when he hits the top note, you're like, wow. So
I love Weezer. I was visually impaired, my right eye doesn't work, and I was like, man, there's nobody cool that wears glasses.
Right.
Rivers, huge inspiration to me, because I was like, oh, he's nerdy but awesome. Yeah, and he's so awesome that he's not nerdy.
He's the coolest guy.
And I want to be that guy.
He's the coolest.
And so here's my quick Weezer story.
Yeah.
I worked on American Idol for 4 years.
Yes, you did.
As the head mentor. I'd mm-hmm. work with the kids, some young adults, on everything from song selection to how to sing it, tempo, being interviewed. They just had me there as the Swiss Army knife.
Right.
And at the end of every season, everybody would come in. All the big stars for duets, right? And
sure.
This artist would be with this person, and Weezer was coming in. Now, I had never met wow. anyone from Weezer, and I was freaking pumped. I'm jaded. Not in a way of, I don't care, but I've seen everybody. I know that most people that I think are awesome at music, sometimes they're not, sometimes they are, but they're just normal folks.
100%.
So, sometimes abnormal, but not in the way you prefer.
Absolutely.
But a Weezer, right? There's like three or four in my whole life that I'm like, I would totally fanboy out. And Weezer's playing the finale of American Idol. So I let my producer know. I said, hey, I'm just letting you know I'm a massive Weezer fan.
Right.
And the whole season, people have been in and out.
Sure.
But I'm not going to go in like, hey, would you sign this? Can I take a picture? I said, Weezer's coming. And if it's cool, I'd like to walk out and just say hello. And they're like, yeah, of course. They're like, it's your show too. There's five of you on this show. Is Luke, Lionel, Katie, Ryan, and myself.
Right.
And so we kind of had free reign over everything. And I said, I'm going to walk out to the bus if that's cool. And they're like, yeah, sure. So they come in and I go to the record store down by where the lot was, and I get the blue vinyl.
Yes.
Because that blue album for me was...
Yeah, it was Near Amoeba, right? It was right
yeah,
there.
Yeah. I mean, it was what I was.
I'm a blue guy more than a Pinkerton guy myself. I agree.
It took me later in life.
Yep. I agree.
To understand and appreciate.
I agree.
So, but blue, loved it immediately. Yeah. I go get it. Big vinyl. I walk up. I'm nervous. Mm-hmm. I'm an adult man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm nervous. Like, yeah. So, hey, guys. My name's Bobby. I'll be working with you guys later tonight. I'm the head mentor here on American Idol. I'm not even going to fake it. I'm just a massive fan. Do you care if, would you guys sign this? I'm like, yeah. And come on in. And so I don't see Rivers at all. And so all the other guys are around, and they're super cool. And they're signing. Hey, man, where are you from? I'm from Arkansas. You guys, all the small talk, mm-hmm. but to me, it means a little more than that. Mm-hmm. To them, just another dude knocking mm-hmm. on the bus door. And so into the star bunk, the door opens and it's Rivers. He just kind of opens it and kind of looks in and he sees me. And the little bat, he's been like, you know, fixing his face. There's like a little mirror, like fixing his hair, doing a little teeth thing. And I'm just going, all right, there he is. Of all the things that I can say, it's like an elevator pitch. And I'm not pitching anything. I just want to let the guy know. But I don't want to let him know so hard that he's creeped out. It's a fine line.
Sure.
But I never met him.
Right.
And so he looks at me and I don't want to yell, hey, will you sign this? But I wanted him to sign this.
Yeah.
And so he goes back to his thing, looks at me again, and he starts to take a step toward me. And I'm like, my heart starts to beat a little bit. I'm like, this is my moment right here. It's about to be time. He takes about a half step forward and then shuts the door and goes back in the room.
No.
And it wasn't toward me. It wasn't toward anything I did. That, you know, I was in his personal space.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Is that album still unsigned in that space?
They sent it back with him.
Okay.
And he was cool enough to sign it.
All right, because I was going to take care of that for you.
You know, and I wasn't upset. Actually, I appreciated that.
No.
Because that was a dude being exactly who he was.
He's awesome. I got to say something about Rivers, which is, you know, one thing I would tell you is Rivers, Pat Monahan, you know, Fitz, like a few of these cats who I really love, and I'm pretty close with. The one thing I'll tell you about all of them is the work ethic is like nothing you've ever seen. Rivers writes like 3 songs a day. Like just absolutely, just to permeate a Weezer record for me is like holy grail, because honestly, I'm competing with the 10 songs Rivers wrote last night. He's so prolific and really good. And
Monahan is the same way and Fitz is the same way. These guys work so hard and we're all the same age. So the notion that, like, you know, you can be this grown ass guy and just hit, like, aggressively want it that bad and chase the art that to that extent. I mean, Rivers, I learned that from more than any other artist. I've never seen somebody work as hard as Rivers does.
Next time you talk to him, tell him I love him.
It's awkward.
I didn't get a chance to tell him that.
It's a little awkward.
But be very awkward and say, yeah, Bobby loves you.
No, I'm actually going to say to him, like, dude, honestly, like,
you shut the bus door on him.
You kind of put the you kind of bust him, you know?
I met Pat probably January of this year for the first time.
Wow.
We were at a Pebble Beach playing the Pebble Beach Pro-Am.
Yeah.
And so I guess this year they finally thought I was famous enough to be invited.
Yeah, I'd put you on it.
And so, well, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And so I go out.
I heard he's not bad.
He's pretty good.
Yeah.
And so, but he was also super kind.
He's a great guy.
Like overly kind to the, where I was like, yeah, man, you do not have to be this nice. But he wasn't being anything that he wasn't.
Oh, he's the best.
And I went and asked a couple other friends that have played it. He was like, oh yeah, Pat Monahan. He's like the greatest dude.
Oh no, he's my guy. Like I owe Pat so much. He's an incredible friend. And honestly, he's always, he's so funny. He's so quick. And he doesn't suffer fools. He's really, he's brilliant.
Let's take a quick pause for a message from our sponsor.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots. And Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct-to-consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com.
Tecovas.com. Tecovas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How do the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer shaped the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed as the Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, that's where they would spur each other and tap into something bigger and something realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Backrack as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer, and the birth of outlaw country music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest. Hey, it's Bobby Bones. I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the kids at St. Jude. St. Jude's been leading the way in the world's best survival rates for some of the most aggressive forms of childhood cancer. Your support means that families never get a bill from St. Jude for treatment or travel or housing or food, so the families can focus on helping their child live. And that really hits home for me because I've been to St. Jude many times. I've hung out with the kids, played music for the kids. I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. Now, I didn't have cancer, but if it wasn't for people stepping up, I don't know that I would have been able to go and stay in the hospital and be taken care of. So that's why we do this, to take care of others. You can help St. Jude stop childhood cancer by becoming a partner in hope. When you do this, you'll get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. So join all the doctors and researchers, you know, and me in this fight, and just text the word Bobby to 785-833. It's only six numbers, but text the word Bobby to 785-833.
And we're back on the Bobbycast.
Bobby, one thing I did want to say to us in the 6 degrees between us, mm-hmm. Do you know where we cross in the greatest way? You're going to dig this. Dancing with the Stars.
Uh-huh.
John Schneider.
Oh, yeah.
Went to my high school.
Really? Duke's a hazard.
He is from upstate New York.
What?
Nobody knows that fact.
What? I didn't know that.
I'm going to throw that out for all the Foxes out there, but John Schneider attended Fox Lane High School. The reason I know that, which is a little interesting aside, is I did always want to get out, and I wanted to get out in the world and do something, you know, something loud in this business. When I was in ninth grade, I used to take the bus every Friday after school, and I'd go to the Bedford Hills Library, and upstairs on the third floor, this little, like, beat-up building, they kept old yearbooks, like the stacks from historically from our high school. So I found both the our Illuminati were John Schneider and Susan Day from the Partridge Family in LA Law. And I would find their yearbooks, and then I would start to create these composites in my brain of how we could have been friends and who they hung out with. I'm trying to figure out who they hung out with and stuff. And I was obsessed with it. So yeah, the John Schneider reveal. So
John Schneider. That shouldn't be from upstate New York. They should have made sure immediately.
From Money Earning Mount Kisco.
He was quite good looking as a young guy.
Yeah.
Good looking older guy, but like really good looking younger guy.
No one's ever accused me of that.
I didn't know you were younger, yeah. I might fall in love with you then, too.
No, I have big doughy features, and I've always have, so they're kind of exaggerated.
I wouldn't say you're doughy at all.
Cartoony, yeah.
Ringo Starr.
Yeah, he's a bully. Ringo Starr. Honestly, show up at Ringo's house. You know, a buddy of mine, Winston Simone, one of the great managers, one of my favorite managers ever in this business. Winston Simone connects me with, word had gotten out that Ringo was open to new collaborators because he's got a really tight circle, right? It's Luke Gethur, it's Joe Walsh, it's
Do you get nervous about the Ringo though? You've been with a lot of people, but it's a Beatle.
I don't get nervous with anybody. And maybe,
still.
Yeah, it's probably, you know, and honestly, it goes back to like the Warhol thing, I think. You know what I mean? Like when you're exposed to stuff so young, you just get kind of numb to it.
Maybe nervous isn't the word. And I don't get nervous really either. Same, like again, but still, I was excited, to meet Rivers.
I mean, I was definitely stoked, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Like, I mean, it's Ringo, you know what I mean? Like, but I was able to at least I was composed, which helps, you know. And I would say I showed up to the house, and we dug in, you know, and we sat down on the couch, and right off the bat, I was like, peace and love, and then with like 6 seconds, it was like he was grilling me like the toughest job interview in history.
For what reason?
Well, I just think like, you know, he probably, you know, he's got his guard up. I think he's probably trying to figure out my motives of why I'm so psyched to work with him, et cetera, you know? And it was very interesting because I tried to punch back whenever he'd say something, I tried to say something witty back and it wasn't landing. And I thought, okay, I've literally screwed up this one opportunity. I'm in my car driving home. And I said to him, I said, you know, I'm going to go home and I'm going to write a song. And if you'll have me back tomorrow, I'll play for you. He said, come at 2 o'clock. So I came back, I wrote this tune, and my boy Grant Michaels, my engineer programmer, is a writer, really talented kid. He reharmed what I was going for because I was trying to do some really Randy Newman-y kind of chordal stuff, and I'm somewhat limited. And I went and sang Ringo the tune, and he's sitting there, it's Ringo and his engineer, Bruce Sugars, his engineer producer, great guy. And these guys are just, they deadpan me, and I sing it, and you know, my voice is, you know, isn't the sexiest tone. It's sort of like, you know, it's that guy in the Budweiser commercial that you turn down, you know? And so I sing this thing for him, and Ringo goes, huh, that's absolute shit. And I was like, wow. And he's so dry, and I'm trying to read him, and he goes, no, I'm joking. I love it. He said, but you know what? You sang me a song. I'm just going to cut you a song. And I said, well, I didn't sing you a second verse or a bridge. He said, And next thing you know, he just ripped into it and wrote a second verse. And this guy like comes alive at a level I've never seen. And his energy is freakish. He's jumping up and down. And I said, it's like one of these kids at a rave. You know, he's like pogoing. And he's 80 at the time. Well, he's probably like 78 at the time. He's pogoing up and down. The best physicality in the world. He's running behind the kit. I'm watching Ringo play, and his pocket is so nasty. And he's doing all the sort of tricks that all
he
the Ringo
still
stuff.
Do them.
Nasty. No embellishment. Incredible feel. His pocket's crazy. And he's doing all the hand percussion. He's singing. He's doing everything. He's running around the room. And I looked at him. It was the first moment I really like felt like, man, if this is how people age now, like, I'm all right with it. You know what I mean? And it's funny because I, over a period, you know, I've worked with some incredible greats of the era, right? Carole King, Ringo, the OJs, Eddie LaVert, my God, Eddie and Walter, Tom Jones, Joe Cocker. One thing I'll say about all these people, Mike Love, they're in the most incredible physical shape. It's humbling. Like every single time, like, you know, I had a night with the OJs and we went out, they played the Apollo Theater and then we all went out for drinks at some hotel bar and it's 2 a.m. and Eddie LaVert is going. He's like, we're not done. We're not done. He's dancing around more Blanco. You know, these guys, like, they live it. And the fact that they have that energy makes me just feel so good as a, you know, as I hit 30 now.
I felt that.
You know what I mean?
I got 4 final questions. Number one is, I was watching, my TikTok lets me watch a lot of late 60s, early 70s, especially singer-songwriter, kind of acoustic.
I want your TikTok.
Ish. That's where I live, and 90s wrestling.
You know what mine is?
What?
Mine's usually like, it's usually like a young artist, usually from Nashville or something along the lines. It's like, hey, they're in their car and the camera's looking at me and go, hey, I just broke up with my girlfriend today and I wrote a song about it. You want to hear it? And then they do the fake turn of the dial and then they lip sync along, do it for a second. They do a lot of hand movements and that's when I just keep scrolling past. Sorry, I digress.
That's ADHD. I don't live there. I see those sometimes. Yeah. They said to me, but I don't live there.
I want to live where you live. All right, so go ahead.
Sorry. Where I live's cool because I see a lot of Tom Jones singing either live or like on a television studio
set.
I had no idea. Beast. Because the Tom Jones version that I know from my life is older Tom Jones.
He's a caricature.
Yeah.
Oh, he's a beast. He's a real soul singer.
One of the best I've ever heard.
He's like a superstar.
That good. I watched him and Ray Charles sing together.
Yeah. No, he
had, back and forth.
Yeah, Tom Jones had all the respect. I mean, like, he's literally, look, he's one of those British, like, sort of just like soul, like, legends.
He was so good.
Yeah, no, it's funny because, like, his pop cultural presence, I think, is so different from actually the core of his voice. He's a singer.
And then I heard him sing later, maybe like 2 years ago, on The Voice in Another Country.
Yeah.
As an older guy.
Still sings
dope. And still sings. So
yeah,
I just had no idea.
You know, I'm like a fetishist for raspy vocals. You know what I mean? So coming out of the UK, there's all those cats like Tom Jones or Chris Rea, who's like very forgotten. But Chris Rea, you know, certainly in the States, over there he's big. But like, it's a gravel. And when singers come along and have that British gravelly thing, man, I'm the first guy at the record store. You know what I mean? Every single time. It's my favorite voice. Cocker. I mean, come on. It's like literally like
if you're going to sweat that much when you sing, I need to appreciate that.
Exactly.
But Joe Cocker, like, you know, you're 1/3 of the way into a Cocker show, or I would watch him live. I didn't get to go watch him in person.
Yeah.
But I would watch Cocker live. The guy's pouring sweat, like wiping himself down, singing ballads.
Well, the problem is, like, the bar was so high. You know, these guys, the performance level and the way they just left it all out on the stage. And there are very few singers I would say the same thing about now. It's not the same level of commitment, you know? Like, Cocker's thing was unbelievable. It's just...
And to cover a Beatles song...
You're right, right.
And there are a lot of... And listen, I love a lot of Joe Cocker, but I think how ballsy to cover a Beatles song, period, but then you do have big balls when you do it and you nail it.
I mean, it's one of the greatest covers ever. And the intro, it's so... Was it the Wonder Years?
So,
you know, it was, you know, once again, it's that intro. I mean, you are so, like, that's an intro that'll suck you in. You instantly know that record right off the bat. And, I mean, his commitment level on that vocal. And I'm with you, man. Like, I feel like when people bludgeon classics, it's, you know, it's a no-can-do for me. You know what I mean?
He kind of sucks you in at the beginning of all of his songs. I mean, even going, You Are So Beautiful to Me, right? The piano comes on, and it's that first vocal note, and you're like, well, this is different.
How about You Can Leave Your Hat On, or any of the 80s stuff? I mean, it was just consistent, you know? It really, really, one of the greatest singers. I didn't get to know him or anything. He just cut one of the songs, but he's incredible, you know?
So my second book that I wrote was called Fail Until You Don't, and... It was basically me just screwing up.
Right.
And in some of the conversation we've had, I knew the answers to. I just wanted to walk down it with you. But I knew, listen, your rap career didn't go well. A DJ, you know, you weren't near as good as I am, let's be honest. Oh. You know, I made a big career out of this, and you've done fair at what you're doing.
I do have a face for radio.
So you have all, but why was it important to you in this book to showcase the difficult times as the main theme?
I'll tell you, because... you know, my daughter's 17, so what is that, Gen Z or whatever? You know, I'm scared for these kids because when you have so much technology at your hands and so much, everything is just pulling at your attention 24 hours a day, I'm scared that these kids might not have the same work ethic because I think they might get just constantly pulled and like, hey, I don't want to do this very long and maybe I'll do this job for 6 weeks and maybe I'll do this and quit this and quit this and quit this. And I stuck something out against improbable odds and it was the greatest decision of my life. And I think I want to speak to two people with this book. One, to the youth, just to say there is a pathway, but I want you to be aware of what you're entering. Right, you have to understand you're going to get failed 2,000 times. 2,000 no's. Matt Del Negro, my buddy's book. It's like 2,000 no's. It's just the truth. The rejections, you have to use them as scars. You know, you have to take those scars and take those calluses and have them fuel you to go forward. But if you don't have that wiring and if you're going into this delusionally thinking, okay, like once again, like I got TikTok famous last night, I had a song and went viral, blah, blah, blah. You don't understand what you're in for if you want to do this as long as I've been doing it. The rejections will mount at a freakish level. And I just want people to be aware of it, but there is a way out. And the other thing is I really wanted to reach anybody who has creative wiring who just might have packed it in early. You know, because I was blessed. Look, I came up in the city, and you know, we're in the East Village in New York. And I would say, if I came up with like 100 cats in that time, you know, 5-6 of us left doing it. You know what I mean? Like most people went on to different things. Some because they lost interest, and others because they just couldn't feasibly make it work anymore. I kind of want to speak to those people and say, you know what? Give it another shot. Give it another shot. It's not, you're not done by any stretch because honestly, if you are as tenacious about it as I was, you can probably, you know, I don't know what goal, you know, you have to ascertain your own goals, but like you could, you know, you could do something special. It's just, here's case in point of somebody who was like moderately gifted at best when he started and just got better, you know?
Third question of four, why now though?
Because I felt like I was still like mildly culturally relevant and my fear was, you know, in a decade from now, some of these songs might not have the same resonance and I want to do it when people actually might still take my phone calls, you know, including a publisher. It's like, you know, I don't know if a book deal, you know, in 10 years from now, if a publisher would have been interested. But also, look, we're in such a crazy time, right? We're entering into the AI phase and all these other, you know, technological advances that are going to just absolutely affect the music. It's just obvious where all this stuff is headed. And it felt like a nice moment to pivot creatively for a second and to just get out of the fray, clear my head, write everything. This is all me. There's no co-writers or ghostwriters. It's literally 300 zillion pages of my psyche. But I felt like this was like a rinse out. And then I'm going to come back with like just stronger than ever because I feel so creatively sort of motivated because I needed the break.
My final question is just two words with a question mark at the end of it.
Aries.
Close.
Okay.
Baja Men? Question mark.
All right. So you guys are all very familiar with Who Let the Dogs Out. So let's not make it weird between us.
Couldn't be more.
Yeah. So I didn't do that one.
Okay.
I did the follow up. It was called Move It Like This. It was recorded in the Bahamas with the Baja Men. A couple little fun facts for you. One, the Baja Men stole my headphones and didn't return them, which was kind of dark. So if you ever like are on a cruise ship and you see one of the Baja Men guys wearing nice pair of Panasonic headphones from back in the day, I think you could make a case for me. Second of all, we did get yelled at. There was a McDonald's in the Bahamas, and me and Mike Mangini, my buddy, and Dave Schomer, we were working with these guys, and we had a 12 noon session, and Mike walked through the door at 12:02 carrying a couple bags of McDonald's for us, and the leader of the Baja Men screamed at him about being late and that McDonald's should never be a priority. And by the way, remember I didn't learn from mistakes, right? I've learned from mistakes. I have never let McDonald's be a priority in my, you know, my bookings ever again.
You never know where you will learn something.
From a Baja Men.
It could be in the Bahamas with the Bahama Men.
You know, I gambled down there. We went to the Paradise. What's it called? What's a Compass? What's a big casino in
I don't Bahamas? Know. I've been down there, but I didn't go to the casino. Yeah. I don't trust it.
There's a casino. So, you know, and I won like $900, which was so huge for me. And I'm so cheap, you know, everyone's goading me. They're like, double down. I'm like, $900, this is a new stereo. And I took it back to York and I bought this shitty stereo. It was amazing. Proudest moment of my life.
Listen, this has been, I could do this for 2 hours. Hey. We've done over an hour here. I'm just a massive fan of your work.
Brother, I'm a bigger fan. And honestly, this, you have no idea how much means to me, man. You're an icon. You're a beacon of light for the community. And also, you did great work with music, Musicians on Call, which I know of. So it's awesome.
Well, thanks. I appreciate the time. Everybody, 21 Hit Wonder, if they want to order it.
Yeah, I mean, just go to Amazon and, you know, and order it. And if they have any questions, they can always hit me on the gram. I'm on the gram.
Just give out your number. They'll text you.
Yeah, they can, you know, it's great. It's good. Thanks.
All right. You guys follow Sam Hollander on Instagram. 21 Hit Wonder is the book. And you still making money off all these songs? Still coming in pretty regularly?
I sold my catalog.
You did? Yeah. Is that in the news? At how much?
It was. I would never let that out, but, you know, it was great. So I did it in 2019, fought to Hypnosis, and...
You sold it all?
I did.
Over 10 million? It doesn't matter. Okay, all right.
As I always say to my daughter, over 10 million doll hairs. So, no, I did great. And everything I have going forward since 2019 is mine, and hopefully I'll sell another one. But what it did was it really freed me up to do things like this and, you know, just be a better human.
When did you write records?
That's 2021, so I own records.
We're on the way.
We're on our way. That's the beginning. That's the next wave.
I got records in my head. Jam. Sam, thank you, buddy.
Dog. Thank you for having me, guys.
Thanks for listening to a Bobbycast production.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait.
Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.